From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It seems like some things never change. Take our relationship with Russia over nuclear weapons. Just last week, President Obama offered to cut the nuclear arsenal of the U.S. by a third if Russia would follow along. Russia reacted with skepticism and said it was hard to take the proposal seriously while Washington continued to pursue missile defense technology. Now, the particulars are different, but it's the same sticking point that killed a remarkable agreement between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev in 1986. Today in the program, we're talking with the historian Richard Rhodes about that meeting. Rhodes has said he was dazzled by the debate in 1986, so he wrote a play to reveal the drama that played out behind closed doors. Rhodes is in town for a reading of his play. It's named after the setting for the summit, Reykjavik. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian Richard Rhodes is our guest. For more than 30 years now, Rhodes has been writing narratives of the nuclear age. He's won a Pulitzer Prize telling this story. He's in Utah this week for a reading of a play he wrote about the 1986 summit between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev in Reykjavik, Iceland. What drew Rhodes to the story was not just the extraordinary proposals the leaders were working through and the fact that they came so close to beginning a process of basically eliminating all of the world's nuclear weapons. That is enough drama for a play, but then you add two remarkable characters with remarkable backstories and incredibly high stakes. The play is named after the setting for that summit, Reykjavik, and we're talking about it today. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Richard Rhodes is a journalist and historian. Among his many books is The Making of the Atomic Bomb. That's the one that earned him the Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction. The play is based on his research, which we'll be talking about, from his book, Arsenals of Folly, The Making of the Nuclear Arms Race. And tonight, Plan B Theater Company is presenting a reading of the play, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. But Richard Rhodes, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us. Well, I guess I wanted to start with you've written about that first time Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev met. This was November 1985, and it was supposed to be kind of a perfunctory thing, I guess it was, 15 minutes or so, but you say it took about an hour. And I'm wondering, did they hit it off or what was it?
They did hit it off. They both wanted to, I guess, advance the agendas that both had come to this meeting with, even though it was supposed to be a photo op. Basically, they walked off to a separate building in the compound where they were meeting and sat in front of a fireplace and talked with nothing more than their translators around. So already at the beginning, when they really had quite a bit standing between them, disagreements. Yeah. Remember, Ronald Reagan was quite the hawk.
Yeah.
And the Soviets had shot down a plane. There was a good deal of difficulty going on in their relationship. Nevertheless, they liked each other.
Well, that seems the key to this. And I think in some ways what is, makes the play so interesting is the personal dynamic between the two. You've written about how when Gorbachev returned to Moscow from Geneva, that he had mixed feelings about Ronald Reagan. On one hand, he was hearing all this rhetoric coming out of Reagan, you know, the evil empire, all that kind of thing. Reagan's first press conference, he said kind of dastardly things about the Soviet Union, which was amazing. So he had that on one hand, Gorbachev. But then he thought something else about him, and I'm wondering what it was, because you say in your book, he figured he could work with him.
I think that that's the mysterious and interesting part of the relationship between the two men. Mm. And for me, it's traces to one central fact. They were both outsiders. They weren't professionals who had grown up within the establishments of their individual countries. Reagan, as we know, was an actor.
Yeah.
And came pretty late to politics. And Gorbachev was a farmer's son. And really, unlike the city slickers in Moscow whom he was working with, whom he could dance rings around on almost any occasion, he really actually was concerned that the Soviet people weren't doing very well and wanted to change that.
So, well, he'd been in the Ministry of Agriculture, where, as you say, he saw how really bad it was.
Yes, he came to Moscow to the Politburo, the central governing group of the Soviet Union, as Minister of Agriculture,
right,
not of Foreign Affairs or was something else. And the first problem was exactly they didn't have enough wheat. They didn't have enough to eat. They had to buy their wheat from the United States. And President Reagan, among other things, made that contingent upon some improvements in human relations in the Soviet Union. So they already were connecting at the very outset of their relationship.
At what point did you figure, you've written so much about it. At what point did you figure, I want to do a play?
You know, when I was going through the transcripts of the Reykjavik summit in order to write about it in my book, Arsenals of Folly, the Reykjavik summit was the climactic episode of that book.
Yeah,
I was just struck with how inherently dramatic these dialogues were between these two men, and struck as well with the fact that the American version of what was said and the Russian version, which I got my hands on and had translated, were different. Now, these were supposed to be basically just transcriptions.
Right.
In the way it's done in the United States, there's a rapporteur who writes down a kind of third-person version of what was said. Mm. The Soviet Union, not surprisingly, given how dangerous things could be there, was basically a court stenographer transcription.
And No spin.
And what struck me in what was supposed to be on the American side, as on the Soviet side, a primary historic document, the Americans had very carefully left out every time Reagan talked about the elimination of nuclear weapons. Hmm. I only knew that he talked about that because it was in
the Soviet Russian transcript.
Right. So already some of the dynamics and some of the tensions that were in this story – President Reagan's advisors laughed at him behind his back whenever he discussed the idea of getting rid of nuclear weapons. Mm. They thought it was silly, maybe senile. They didn't take him seriously. Whether he knew that, I don't know. But he took himself quite seriously.
Yeah.
So the transcripts looked like something that should be turned into a play. And then I had to face the fact that I'd never written a play before. which I solved by buying about 100 different modern plays.
There's and just going through them?
And reading them carefully, reading a couple of books on playwriting, and then fools jump in, as they say.
There's a really dramatic moment in the play, which we'll come to later in the show, where Ronald Reagan has this exuberance that's equal to Gorbachev's about this prospect of let's get rid of these weapons.
Right.
That's interesting to hear that the American version of that story, you didn't hear that exuberance. You didn't hear Ronald Reagan expressing that.
There's everything around it, but not the specific statement of let's get rid of them all.
Yeah.
Because his advisors didn't want us to understand that.
I want to talk about the public personas of these men and the stakes that they were getting from domestic politics, because this is central to understanding the story. But let's get into the characters for a moment, because this is interesting, your brief character description of Ronald Reagan at the beginning of your play. It's interesting. You say, the 40th president of the United States, a former lifeguard.
Yes.
75. Explain why a former lifeguard is so important.
Late in adolescence, I think his final year in high school, Ronald Reagan, who grew up in a small town in Illinois, worked as a lifeguard on the Rock River outside of Dixon, Illinois. He worked basically from dawn to dusk. He was the only lifeguard at this riverside swimming area that the town supported. And his job was, of course, to save people who were drowning. In the course of – I guess he actually did this for more than one summer. But in the course of his short career as a lifeguard, he saved 77 people from drowning. I have a moment in the play where he tells Gorbachev that, and Gorbachev says, 77 people? Yes, sir, I certainly did. And he said, and they had to be seriously at risk because I only had one bathing suit, said Reagan, and I didn't like to walk around in a clammy suit. So he really – there are some biographers of Reagan who suggest that his fundamental character was formed by that experience.
Yeah.
That is to say, he liked the idea of being someone who could save the world, but he didn't really want to be too close to the people he saved. Mm. He was famously distant even from his own children,
yeah,
for all his charm. That's the story that I have him tell to Gorbachev,
yeah,
as a way of really deeply understanding where he was coming from.
We're going to hear that scene here in just a moment. But let's talk about the Gorbachev part of that.
Yeah.
Because the other thing that Gorbachev reveals, among other things, is the what he saw in the war in World War II in 1943. This is the other dynamic.
Right. Gorbachev, who grew up on a collective farm, as I said, as the son of a farmer, and who, I think we should note, won a four-year scholarship to the best university in the Soviet Union, Moscow University, at the age of 17, by combining more wheat in one summer than any other adolescent in the entire Soviet Union. He got also a Lenin medal, an Order of Lenin medal for that. And he said late in life, I treasure that medal more than all the others that I've won.
Yeah.
So Gorbachev had a different background from all these other guys who ran the country in the Soviet Union. He also, as a young man who was a teenager during the Second World War, saw the German invasion of the Soviet Union on intimate terms. The Germans advanced through his village, moved on farther east, and then once the Soviets began to force them back, they retreated through his village, going back to Germany. He had an intimate relationship or acquaintance with war.
Yeah.
And he particularly and nightmarishly recalled a time when the boys were out playing, he and his gang, and they came across the dead bodies, the skeletal dead bodies of Russian soldiers lying in an area where they'd been attacked and bombarded with cannon shells, and the horror of that, these skull faces staring out of,
yeah,
their helmets, stayed with him. He says in the play, as he said in one of his memoirs, it burned us. We were the war generation, and we were never like the others.
Let's hear this scene from the play Reykjavik. And we should say that Gorbachev, there's this give and take. Gorbachev is making these proposals. And the sticking point, which becomes the sort of fatal sticking point, of course, is he wants Ronald Reagan to concede on the Strategic Defense Initiative on Star Wars.
Exactly.
This is a crucial point. We'll get to that, why he was so set on this as we go. But here's that scene that Richard Rhodes was referring to from his play Reykjavik. We're going to hear Robert Scott Smith, a good friend of ours, a terrific actor, reading the part of Ronald Reagan, and Jason Tatum as Mikhail Gorbachev. And gentlemen, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us. Here's a scene.
Thank you.
From Reykjavik.
You began the meeting yesterday by saying we both came from nowhere. It's true, we did. So, how did we get here? Why are we here, you and me? Have you thought about that?
Many times. I've heard more than one psychiatrist say that we imbibe our ideals with our mother's milk. Maybe so. My mother, Nellie, was a peacekeeper and a pacifist. Maybe I get that drive from her. But what comes to mind first of all is the 7 summers I spent as a lifeguard on the Rock River in Dixon, Illinois. I worked 7 days a week from dawn to dusk. $15 a week. Lifeguarding's a great way to learn about people. I saved a grand total of 77.
You rescued 77 people from drowning?
Yes, sir, I did. And everyone needed saving. No lifeguard gets wet without a good reason. In my case, it took a real emergency. I was on duty full-time, so a clammy swimsuit was no fun, and I was too money-conscious to buy a spare one. I didn't get much in the way of thanks, either. The only reward I ever got was $10 from an old man who lost his upper plate going down the slide. I dove in and brought it up from the bottom of the river.
What is, upper plate?
His false teeth. You know what? People hate to be saved. Almost everyone I dragged out denounced me. I would have been fine if you'd left me alone. You made a fool out of me trying to be a hero.
People hate to be saved. I'll remember that. I earned a 4-year university scholarship by combining more wheat in one summer than any other 17-year-old in the entire Soviet Union.
The Gorbachevs.
The Gorbachevs. And an Order of Lenin medal. My favorite, even after all these years. I wanted to study physics when I went up to Moscow University.
Why didn't you?
To study physics, one had to qualify for a security clearance.
I see. For weapons research. And you didn't.
No. My grandfather was an enemy of the people.
And now you're general secretary.
Yes. Life isn't bounded by security clearances. But I think first of the war. One horrible image. In the spring of 43, when the snow had melted, we children roamed through the countryside looking for trophies. The Germans who'd advanced through our village had retreated by then. We came to a remote stretch of woods and stumbled onto the remains of Red Army soldiers who'd fought their last battle there the previous summer. I still have nightmares. Decaying corpses that animals had scavenged. Skulls in rusted helmets. Bleached bones. A light machine gun red with rust. Some hand grenades. Heaps of empty cartridges. The bodies lay in the thick mud of the trenches and craters, staring at us out of black, gaping eye sockets. It was horror. Unspeakable. My generation is the generation of wartime children. It burned us. It left its mark on our character and on our view of the world.
It's Jason Tatum as Mikhail Gorbachev. Robert Scott Smith is reading the part of Ronald Reagan in the play Reykjavik. Tonight at 7, Plan B Theater Company is offering the reading. It's free. There are only a handful of tickets left, we should say. There will be a waiting list for empty seats starting at 6:30. Richard Rhodes is going to be on hand for a conversation following the play. It's going to be hosted by Mary Dixon of KUED Channel 7. For all of those details, visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Richard Rhodes is the author of 4 books on the nuclear age. He, of course, wrote the play. He's with us today in the program, and we need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian and journalist Richard Rhodes is joining us. Rhodes won a Pulitzer Prize for his writing on the nuclear age. He's in Utah for a reading of a play that he's written about the 1986 summit between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, where they came this close to agreeing to begin the process of eliminating all of the world's nuclear weapons. The play is called Reykjavik. There's a reading tonight offered by the Plan B Theater Company. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. You can join us if you have a comment or a question, 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So Richard Rhodes, help us sort of orient ourselves on the weapons. At the time, this is 1986, there were a total of 60,056 known nuclear weapons in the world.
Right.
Put that in perspective for today, if you would, where we are today compared to then.
The United States and Russia are down to about a total of 10,000 between them, still way far more than you would need to basically destroy the entire human world. It's been difficult to get the Russians to go much lower because they no longer can afford a big military. And it's always been a trade-off for countries, nuclear weapons versus a large military. That's why they've been so reluctant. President Obama mentioned just last week that he would like to see some further mutually agreed upon non-treaty-based cuts between the two sides. But I think that's going to be difficult for the Russians to agree to.
Well, it's interesting how much the sticking point is still the same in some ways.
Yeah.
It's that concern over the fact that the United States is insisting on some sort of strategic defense.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment because it's the essence of Gorbachev's concern in the play,
yes,
as it was in the actual summit. if you have a defense of any kind that's capable of hitting some warheads as they come out of space, or in space for that matter, you're not going to be able to get them all if there's a big launch. If there are 1,000 weapons launched at you, there may be only 5% that you miss.
Right.
But 5% of strategic warheads is enough to take out all the major cities in a country. So as long as it's a big launch, then you can be comfortable even if the other side has some kind of strategic defense. But if both sides agree to begin reducing their weapons and they cut down to, let's say, 100 weapons,
mm-hmm.
it may well be possible for a strategic defense system to take out all of those warheads. That would mean that the side that had the strategic defense would basically have, as President Reagan liked to call it, a shield
yes.
against a launch from the other side, and therefore could attack with impunity. That's what Gorbachev and his people were concerned about, because it was clear that the Soviet Union was nowhere near building any kind of strategic defense system. They had not even had much luck building a desktop-sized computer.
All right. Well, it's interesting because Ronald Reagan, in the play, in the experience, he says, look, we will share with you this technology.
Yes.
Now, Gorbachev is dubious, of course. He said, look, you won't even share us the technology of a milking machine.
Right, exactly.
So why would you share that with us? Was Ronald Reagan in earnest? Would the United States really conceivably have shared these secrets with
the
Soviets?
When I wrote the play, I didn't understand how he could be. After all, we're talking about what, from the military's point of view, was an offensive system. But Ronald Reagan did decide to share what we now call GPS.
Mm-hmm.
GPS was originally a secret military system that was designed to allow us, of course, to launch all sorts of things and hit very close to their targets because of the guidance involved. He decided that GPS should be shared with the world when the Soviet Union shot down the Korean airliner
yeah.
in, was it 1983, mm-hmm. I believe? Some of your listeners will remember that time. That airliner got off course because it was using an inertial guidance system and it wasn't working properly. And the Soviets, not knowing what else to do, shot it down and killed 250 people. It was
yeah.
a great scandal and a great horror. Reagan decided that the whole world needed to have access to GPS, and he determined and allowed, of course, now we know, that everyone should indeed have the system. So I don't know. Maybe it would have been possible to share an SDI system, but an SDI system as he conceived it was not going to be possible anyway.
Yeah. Did he know that?
No, he didn't know that.
No.
It really was not until we'd spent $90 billion that in 1993 that effort at a space-based defense system was finally canceled.
Isn't that such a tragedy? Because this was the sticking point. This whole idea, Ronald Reagan was so wed to this idea that we have the capacity to be able to develop such a system. And so he stood his ground. And it collapsed, that meeting.
Indeed. And there are two things to say about that. One is President Reagan didn't trust agreements between countries. He liked to say treaties are a trap. Nobody ever kept their word on a treaty if it was not to their advantage to do so, which really misses the point about why countries make these agreements between themselves. They make the agreements because they are to their advantage.
Yeah.
You know, you don't sign a treaty that's going to take away some advantage that you have without some equal agreement on the other side. So the whole point of treaties is that they work because they're to the mutual benefit of the people who sign them. Reagan didn't really quite see that. He saw treaties as a way for one side to cheat on the other. And there was a whole rhetoric coming from the neoconservatives in the Republican Party at that time that the Soviets always cheated on their treaties and so forth. None of that was really ever very well supported. The other thing is, and I think this is fundamental to the whole question today, as in 1986 about nuclear weapons and whether we can ever get them, get rid of them.
Yeah.
The issue of nuclear weapons in the United States has become an issue of domestic politics. It was always clear to the Republican hawks that if you could be pushing for a technical supposed solution to the nuclear arms race, then you wouldn't have to agree to treaties. You could say, well, we have this other thing, which is even better because we don't have to trust those devious Ruskies.
Right.
And to this day, I think that's the fundamental problem. For example, with President Obama proposing to advance to the next step in treaties, which he proposed last week, which is a treaty that would ban all nuclear testing in the world. That's not a treaty that the Republican Senate is probably likely anytime soon to ratify. So he's stuck with agreements that he can make mutually without having to go through the treaty process.
Is this your takeaway? Do you think of 30 years of looking at all of this, is this one of the things that you've distilled down as being a central issue, and that is this question of domestic politics?
It is, and I really do think that it's the fundamental problem that we have as a country with moving toward fewer nuclear weapons, toward delayed deterrence. When people talk about getting rid of nuclear weapons, one response is always, but we'll never eliminate the knowledge of how to make them.
Yeah.
And of course we won't. What we could do is slowly move to a point where it takes longer than 30 minutes to deliver one.
Right.
With the other side, of course, the other sides now, nuclear powers in the world today, equally agreeing to take their warheads off rapid alert, to physically dismantle them and put the parts in different places, and ultimately to only have them capable of being built from mothballed factories. Some, you know, if you have to deliver something with certainty in 3 months, it's potentially just as good a deterrent as delivering it in 30 minutes, and you have 3 months to try to find some other solution to the problem.
Yeah. Ronald Reagan talks about the fact that if he gave in on this question of strategic defense, it would cause him great damage at home, he said. But then Gorbachev also mentions that if he returned to Moscow and told the people that he was going to allow the United States to test this thing, this shield, in space, they would call him a village idiot. So they both had these domestic politic pressures.
This is the classic story, and I think it's why it makes such good drama between the immovable object and the irresistible force. Both are constrained by the politics of their relationship with their own leaderships as to how far they can go.
But you know what's so profound about that is they both wanted it.
They did, yes. And there I think you have these two people coming from such seemingly different backgrounds and yet remarkably similar. Small town, focused on the people rather than on how much graft you can put together in the Capitol and so forth. Ronald Reagan was not a Washington guy, let's face it. As it turns out, neither was Gorbachev.
Yeah. Here's another great moment, another scene from the play Reykjavik. This is a moment where, and maybe Richard Rhodes, you could set this up for us. There's this moment where Reagan mentions to Gorbachev the nuclear briefing. This is the meeting where a new leader is given the details about the launch codes, all of that kind of thing. And Reagan talks about how he put it off as long as he could. And we get into this moment where you see how much Gorbachev is influenced by Chernobyl. Talk about this moment in the play.
You know, the timing of all these events was so fortuitous for a change in attitude toward these issues. Gorbachev was, of course, as every leader is, horrified because they not only learn where the weapons are and how many and so forth, they also learn what the results would be in some detail. And that's why President Reagan, who really didn't like bad news very much, didn't want to hear it. You know, he was profoundly influenced by the film that was released about that time on television called The Day After, which happens to have been shot in my hometown of Kansas City, Missouri. Local friends of mine were hired as extras for that film. But even that documentary, that drama, which really wasn't nearly a depiction of how ghastly a post-nuclear world would be. They turned it into sort of medieval Europe after the bubonic plague, but it would have been worse than that. In any case, Reagan was quite upset just to see that. So he really didn't want to hear all these things, but he needed to hear these things. And that's, I think, where we get this particular dialogue between the two characters.
Well, here's another scene from Reykjavik. We'll hear again Robert Scott Smith reading the part of Ronald Reagan and Jason Tatum as Mikhail Gorbachev.
When did you have the nuclear briefing?
You mean about launching nuclear weapons? The destruction that would cause? Within a month of taking office?
I put it off for as long as I could. Didn't want to hear it.
Neither did I, but once I became General Secretary...
I've never been so depressed. You know what President Eisenhower said about nuclear war? He said there wouldn't be enough bulldozers to scrape the bodies off the streets.
If it came to that, could you push the button?
Well, I sure wouldn't want to. But damn it, if you attacked us, I'd have to, wouldn't I? I wouldn't have a choice. What about you?
I found my answer at Chernobyl.
What a terrible disaster for your country.
The worst kind of accident. Careless and irresponsible. Ah, it opened my eyes. It told me what my country had become. Not my people. They're deep and solid, but some of our leaders. I knew that everything had to change. Detonating even the smallest nuclear warhead would equal 3 Chernobyls.
Really? 1 warhead, 3 Chernobyls.
Yes. And both of us have tens of thousands, Mr. President. So it wouldn't matter what I did. If you attacked or if I attacked, we'd both be doomed to an agonizing death. First from our cities burning, or later, from the fallout, the radiation. Retaliate or not, it's suicide either way.
Well, that may be. But would you push the button?
Yes, I would, by God. Don't ever doubt that. But what are we going to do about it?
Jason Tatum, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Robert Scott Smith is Ronald Reagan from Reykjavik, written by Richard Rhodes.
I should mention I had to leave out nuclear winter from his list of disasters that would occur following a nuclear war, because it was only later in 86 that the scientists began to realize that there would be consequences to all the soot and smog from the burning cities of a nuclear war that would indeed lower the temperature annually worldwide by about 20 degrees for about 20 years and basically freeze out agriculture and kill 99% of all the people in the world.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about that because I just read something you wrote recently about when you're talking about the stakes, when you're talking about the real implications of nuclear weaponry, you mentioned what would happen, for example, to Washington, D.C.,
yes.
The scope of what would happen. Would you just mention that again? Because we need to keep reminding ourselves of that, it seems.
There's a scholar at Stanford where I have an affiliation named Lynn Eden, who did a study of the nuclear targeting systems that we have and by implication and the Soviet Union had. She was fascinated with the fact that in targeting, we left out the most dramatic effect of a nuclear explosion in the air over a city, which is fire. The reason was that the targeters really didn't want to think about it, honestly. They felt that they couldn't quantify it, that it would be somehow affected by the weather, whether you started a firestorm over a city or not. But with nuclear weapons, you really don't have to worry about the weather. They make their own weather. So if you explode a 300-kiloton, pretty standard U.S. warhead, Soviet warhead 2, over the Pentagon, the immediate effects of the blast would reach out as far as the Capitol, destroying everything between the Pentagon and the Capitol. Well, that's a pretty big circle when you think about it. But the fire results of that explosion, the fact that what we're dealing with here is matter heated to some 100 million degrees in a fireball that starts out about a foot in diameter and, of course, expands very rapidly. That fireball would ignite everything that was flammable all the way out to the beltway around Washington and basically burn everything to ash in that large a circle around the city. And it's bizarre and interesting that our targeters never really took that into account, which is why we had at one point, 50 warheads targeted on Moscow and 10 on a small town outside of Moscow and so forth, and presumably the Soviets on our cities as well. We systematically underestimated the outcome of a nuclear war, partly because if you really looked at the numbers and at the facts, you just simply couldn't plan on having such a war. And in truth, everyone understood that, obviously. The political leadership understood
that. Yeah. We were like Reagan. We didn't want to hear.
Yeah. I quote in one of my books from George Bundy, who was the President Kennedy's national security advisor and later Secretary of Defense under Johnson. But George Bundy says in one of his papers, one bomb on one city of one's own country as a result of a decision that a political leader made would be unthinkable. 10 bombs on 10 cities would be a disaster beyond history. 100 bombs on 100 cities is beyond comprehension. Meaning, basically, no one, no leader in his right mind, knowing the possibility of retaliation, would ever let things get to that point. And with the exception of a few times during the Cold War, things have never gotten to that point. They got nearly to that point during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah. Richard Rhodes is with us, the author of 4 books of the nuclear age. He wrote the play Reykjavik. Tonight at 7 o'clock, Plan B Theater Company is offering a reading of the play in partnership with the Utah Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. That event is free. The only way you're going to get tickets, I'm afraid, is by getting your name on a waiting list starting tonight at 6:30. Richard Rhodes is going to be on hand for a conversation hosted by Mary Dixon of KUED. All of those details are on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the historian and journalist Richard Rhodes. We're talking about his play, Reykjavik. He's in town for a reading of the play. He's going to be on hand for a conversation tonight. Tickets are gone, I'm afraid, for that event. You can get on a waiting list. We'll give you the details about that, though, as we go along. You include, Richard Rhodes, in the play, a moment where Ronald Reagan is writing a letter to his wife. It's interesting. It's tender and it's really candid.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it conveys what most of us already have known, that she really was his greatest confidant.
Yes.
And it's interesting also in the letter Reagan mentions the assassination attempt and that it had given him – he says this later to Gorbachev – that it had given him this kind of special relationship with God, that God had spared him to deal with this matter. Do you know, did Reagan really mention this to Gorbachev? Did he really say?
This letter is actually one of his letters.
Yeah.
You know, it ends with his loving phrase to his wife, good night, middle-sized muffin.
Yeah.
And I really could not invent that as an endearment, middle-sized muffin. So that really is a letter he wrote to Nancy when he was at Reykjavik. So he did obviously feel that way.
It's so interesting, the candor, too, with Gorbachev. There's a moment in the play when he wonders how it's conceivable, Mikhail Gorbachev, that you can be an atheist.
Yes. And indeed, although I made that scene up, he did ask Gorbachev at another meeting, you say the word God a lot. Do you actually believe in God? And, of course, Gorbachev says, well, I'm a Russian peasant. We say God quite a lot. But I think that also is one of the ways that they connect with each other.
There's a kind of teasing that goes on in some ways, but you get a sense that while they're leaders of these big world countries, they really like each other in some ways.
They do, and I think it's not so surprising perhaps that Reagan would like Gorbachev.
No.
Gorbachev was really is quite an extraordinary man. It's a little more surprising given all of the rhetoric that Reagan had applied to condemning the Soviet Union, to condemning communism and so on, that Gorbachev would have liked Reagan. But he found in him, I think, the same thing many people found, a really charming and surprisingly open for someone so closed, if I can say it this way. He was a surprisingly open man about his heart. He could be warm. He obviously cared about more than simply being the president of the United States. He cared about the people. It's sad to me as a liberal Democrat that he was so hostile to government, to taxes, to the things that he did a lot, I think, of unfortunate things to our country because of. But as an international negotiator, he really was quite unusual. And I suppose you have to say, you know, it's a lot easier for Republicans to do these things than it is for Democrats, exactly because of the political conflict of Republicans calling Democrats soft on defense.
Yeah.
It's Richard Nixon who was able to do the opening to China. And if anybody could have started – well, Reagan did start the ball rolling on arms reductions, even though he didn't get the elimination of nuclear weapons. Reykjavik was the beginning of the end of the Cold War.
Mm. How intense did it get? I mean, there's a close call you write about when there's a conversation of this NATO exercise, Able Archer. This was in 1993.
Yes.
And in some ways, you get a sense that Ronald Reagan is sort of paying the price for his rhetoric because, you know, Gorbachev brings up some of that first press conference where he talks about how, you know, the commies, you know, reserve the right to commit any crime and to lie and cheat. And, of course, the evil empire thing comes up and it, you know.
Right.
But then it gets really intense, this exchange. And in the notes, it says they've almost come to blows. Did it really get that intense, that
as far
exchange?
As I know, as far as you can read in a transcript, yeah. Because they were both so determined to make something happen. You know, Reagan went to this conference. His briefing was, don't give anything away. Just if Gorbachev gives you anything, put it in your pocket. In other words, don't negotiate. But he had his own private agenda. Most people don't realize that Reagan was an anti-nuclear guy all the way back to 1946. The Second World War and the use of the first nuclear weapons set him up to be concerned about this for the rest of his life. And one of the main reasons, as it turns out in some of the memoirs of his advisors, that he decided to run for president was to have a chance to put an end to the Cold War and to eliminate nuclear weapons. This doesn't sound very Republican, but that's what he had in his pocket. So when Gorbachev begins to seem to be offering these things, he enthusiastically jumps in. I have him say at one point in the play, well, they told me this wasn't going to be a summit. This certainly is a summit. And then he jumps in and negotiates.
Yeah. I mean, they weren't supposed to sign anything. I mean, the idea was they were just going to maybe chat about a few things and we'll get set up for the meeting that would happen later in Washington.
Exactly.
But then they come to this moment, and this is such a crucial moment in the play. I want to have another scene here. Gorbachev wants it all. He wants all strategic nuclear weapons. And Reagan wants to limit it to ICBMs, and he gets confused. And then there's this kind of momentous moment, and I want you to put this in context, the scene for us, if you would, Richard Rhodes, where Reagan says, let's do it.
Reagan really didn't understand that Gorbachev was proposing a complete elimination of strategic nuclear weapons. He was kind of thinking along the lines of his briefing, medium-range missiles in Europe, da-da-da-da-da. And then Gorbachev says, and it clicks for him. You realize Gorbachev is saying all. And Gorbachev, in the meantime, is trying to figure out what he can get. And so when Reagan suddenly says, well, why don't we just get rid of them all? Gorbachev is very excited. I mean, I can imagine him bouncing in his chair.
Yeah.
Saying, all right, we can do that. And in the real scene where the secretaries of state were also on hand, George Shultz, said in the transcript, yeah, we can do it. Let's do it.
Isn't that a momentous thing?
Oh,
I mean, what an
yes.
amazing moment.
Yes. Now I get chills even telling the story. Right. It's how close the world came to making real progress on this.
Here it is. Another scene from the play Reykjavik. Again, we'll hear from Robert Scott Smith reading the part of Ronald Reagan, and Jason Tatum is Mikhail Gorbachev.
Maybe I'm confused. In the first part, we agree to reduce our strategic nuclear weapons by 50%. Are you saying we should eliminate the other 50% in the second stage?
Exactly. Not only ICBMs, but also bombers and cruise missiles. All of it.
Everything.
Yes. All our strategic nuclear weapons. That's what we talked about.
Well, then why not go the rest of the way?
What do you mean, the rest of the way?
Why not get rid of them all? ICBMs, cruise missiles, bombs, submarine-launched, battlefield weapons, suitcases, everything.
All nuclear weapons? Everything? Do you know what you're proposing?
Of course I know. What do you take me for?
Truly. All. Everything? We can do that. Yes, everything.
Every damned last one of them.
Let's eliminate them all.
Can we agree by the end of the 10-year period to nuclear abolition? No more nuclear weapons anywhere in the world.
Yes, all nuclear weapons.
Can't you just see it now? The two of us coming back here to Reykjavik with the last two nuclear weapons in the world. I'd be so old you wouldn't recognize me. I'd say, "Hello, Mikhail," and you'd say, "Ron, is that you?" We'd stand together and break a bottle of champagne over the damned things before they chopped them up for scrap. Then the whole world would have a tremendous party.
Who can measure the fear we've lived with all these years? How will it feel to lay it down? We call our meetings summits, but that would be a true summit, with a different country on the other side. A different world. I don't know if I'll live that long. And I still have to face President Reagan, who really hates to give in.
What do you mean, give in?
Here we have a chance for a truly historic agreement. The Soviet side has made many concessions. Now we must have one concession from you.
Oh, good Lord, not that again.
The ABM treaty has to be strengthened, which means we can't remove the language about laboratories from the text. Concede that, and we have an agreement.
And Richard Rhodes, he can't concede that.
He can't, no. It's so deeply fundamental to his feeling of security for the country. I mean, above and beyond whatever political repercussions, his whole logic over his life as from 46 onward had been built around trying to figure out how to deal with the possibility of someone cheating.
Yeah.
And when Edward Teller, my Iago in an earlier version of the play, when Edward Teller whispers in his ear, SDI,
yeah,
he feels he's found the key to what he's dreamed of all his life. So it's the crucial piece. It's the keystone in the arch. And he can't say, yes, you can have that. Even though Gorbachev, in his different view, has tried to make it clear that this is a common problem, that the only way to solve it is to work together in common, that it's bigger than any one country. It's just Reagan had worked and worked and thought and thought and come to this answer. And he couldn't let it go. And, of course, Gorbachev was constrained by the Politburo.
Yeah.
They'd been willing to let him talk about getting rid of nuclear weapons, having been fooled by him. And he said, I want to talk about that. And they said, oh, sure, go yeah. make that noise some more. That's fine. We do that all the time. But he'd said, no, seriously. And they'd say, oh, wait, all right. But only if you make them get rid of SDI. So irresistible force, immovable object.
And there's the pinnacle right there. And yeah. from there, it just falls apart.
Yeah. Till finally they walked out of that curious little house in Reykjavik, very angry at each other.
It's funny. You see pictures of them in those last moments.
You can see the anger.
And you can see the real anguish on one hand
yes.
and real
yes.
anger, I
yeah.
think, too.
Reagan said later, I was angrier then than I've ever been in my life. Which I think measures how much hope he had of making this happen.
Whose fault? Maybe that's a dumb question, but who do you blame here? Gorbachev is proposing extraordinary cuts. Reagan doesn't take him up on it because of his commitment to this program whose technology is uncertain. Who's to blame? Is that the wrong question?
Well, I think it's important to look at the backgrounds these two men came from. In an earlier version of the play, I've been working with the director, Tyler Marchant, on developing this play. Tyler said, this is unbalanced. Gorbachev can't just be the good guy.
Yeah.
So why would Reagan not be willing to agree with Gorbachev? The answer, of course, is the whole history of the Soviet Union that Gorbachev represented. Yeah. And under those circumstances, however perhaps good a man he was or perhaps not, he stood for a country that had violated its treaties, that had oppressed peoples and so forth. Reagan couldn't simply take him at his word.
Right.
And so the tragedy that's in the background is that both countries didn't trust each other enough to take this very difficult step. To say we're going to give up nuclear weapons is to say we're going to give up what we think makes us most secure. I don't believe it does, but our leaders believe it does. Mm-hmm. And more to the point, the people who elect them believe it does. And until we get past that, I think it's going to continue to be this kind of struggle.
About 30 seconds left. Let me ask you this brief question. Could they have done it? Could they have actually done it, do you think?
Yes, I think they could have. Finally, President Reagan turned to his advisors. And the one advisor who told him it would destroy SDI was the infamous Richard Pearl, who truly was an Iago under those circumstances. If Pearl had not been there, George Shultz said, "This is the best deal we've seen in 25 years, Mr. President." I think it would have happened. I don't know that we would have gotten rid of nuclear weapons, but I think we would have moved a little faster in that direction.
Richard Rhodes, he's the author of The Making of the Atomic Bomb and of the play Reykjavik. Tonight at 7 o'clock, Plan B Theater Company is presenting a reading as part of the Script in Hand series. It's co-sponsored by the Utah Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. You heard earlier on the program from Robert Scott Smith reading the part of Ronald Reagan and Jason Tatum, who read the part of Mikhail Gorbachev. And gentlemen, thanks to you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Richard Rhodes, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We should mention he's going to be on hand for a Q&A hosted by KUED's Mary Dixon immediately following the event. Go to our website for the particulars. Radio West, a production of KUER News, with thanks to Walker Adams. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.